my father, who had been at that time about 10 years cancer-free, about 10 years prior, he did have a stint with throat cancer and got through it. Basically, by 2014, had a reoccurrence, and it came on strong. It became clear that Christmas of 2014 was going to be his last one. And this is at the exact same time that I'm trying to organize in my brain what I want to do with life. He knew of my struggles in my career and my wondering if I needed to do something different. And although he passed away in early 2015 before I made the jump from the law to photography, he did make clear that I should follow happiness and that I should do what I love.
Welcome to the Stokecast, where each week we bring you an inspiring athlete, adventurer, or entrepreneur and dig into their stories and strategies for balancing work, life, and adventure while having fun and making a difference. I'm Jonathan Ronzio.
And I'm Emily Holland. Thanks for joining us today.
Let's get to it. Yo, what up, E-Halls? And what's going on, Stokecast Nation? Welcome back for another week.
I like the greeting of yo, what up, E-Halls. Like, that is probably the best thing that's happened to me today. So that's good.
You dig it. I thought you might. Thought you might dig it.
I love it. Who do we have on this week?
We've got Scott Kranz on this week, which I'm really excited. I'm excited every week for every interview. Obviously, we always say that we have the best person, and we're always so stoked about who we're talking to, as we should be, because we only get the most fire guests on the Stokecast for you.
Cream of the crop, yeah.
But no, Scott has such an interesting story. Currently, if you follow Scott Kranz on Instagram, you'll know that Scott is a full-time commercial and outdoor photographer. He's a storyteller. He specializes in sports and outdoor lifestyle and landscape and travel imagery. He's a mountaineer. He lives out in Seattle, and he's constantly climbing around the national parks around there, especially the North Cascades, which we talk about a lot in the show, and specifically a project called the 50 Peaks Project that he did last year and now has a book coming out for. So we'll get into all of that for sure in the conversation. But the really interesting side of Scott is that, you know, that wasn't his pursuit, his professional pursuit for forever, right? Like, Scott was actually a practicing lawyer. He's from the Midwest, and he's an attorney, and did not have this kind of background as a photographer or a mountaineer in any way. And really, just in the last few years, took a leap and leaned into it. And what, you know, the catalyst for him taking that leap was actually a really emotional story.
Yeah, it was really beautiful. And I'm just like such a sucker for when people do unexpected shifts in their career. So when someone moves from attorney to full-time, you know, outdoor photographer, I'm like, yes, I want to know everything about this transition. And I loved it. And it was beautiful. And it was, you know, there's some life things that happened that made us all think a little bit, I think, during the interview. And I think it was a wonderful conversation. So please enjoy our conversation with Scott Kranz.
Hi, Scott. Welcome to the Stokecast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. It's much earlier for you than it is for us, so we appreciate you getting up early and getting after it with us.
Yeah, Scott, what time is it there, you said?
So I am in Arizona at the moment, although I live in Seattle, but it is just past 7 a.m. here. But I'm an early riser, so this is all good. Happy to be here chatting with you guys.
Yeah, no, appreciate it. So regarding your early risedness, making up words already.
That's a technical term.
That's the technical term for it.
Getting up early.
Yeah. What kind of, like, what's your morning routine like?
Oh, geez. You know, it's become clear that since I've been doing photography full time over the last, you know, over 4 years now, I have not had much of a routine. I can try to, you know, put maybe two or three different types of days in a bucket or a stereotype, if you will. One type of day is, you know, basically normal entrepreneurial business where I'm behind the computer, I'm making calls, I'm preparing, you know, pitch decks, editing photos, things like that. And then another typical day is incredibly different, where I'm out in the field, whether it's in the mountains or the deserts or what have you. And, shooting projects, shooting assignments, tackling whatever, you know, sometimes getting images for, just for my own portfolio or things of that sort. So yeah, at least two different, very different kinds of days. And yeah, I sadly or not sadly don't have a typical kind of day, but it keeps things exciting for sure.
Yeah, there's no, you know, whether it's that entrepreneurial day or the field day, there's no common denominator of like, I got to get up and have my coffee and go for my run and meditate and whatever before diving into anything else.
You know, and I'm glad you brought that up. I've always been one, it's been difficult for me to develop and fast habits over the course of my life. I've tried so many times to get up and, you know, develop a habit of say meditating for 5-10 minutes. And I've gone on long streaks, but then, you know, travel comes up, you know, a big piece of travel comes up or a big project comes up and it kind of like derails me. So I'm very much in the process of still developing, you know, still trying to develop those habits in the morning. Yeah, generally speaking, I'm getting up and I do my best not to check, you know, say my email right away. And, you know, my wife and I being Seattleites are big coffee drinkers, of course. So we have our coffee ready and, you know, generally just try to get in a good mindset, whether it's, reading a little bit the news or another, anything online kind of related to my work or the outdoors. I do occasionally meditate. Like I said, I haven't gotten into that, you know, strict routine, which I would very much welcome. I do see benefit in, meditating on a regular basis, but it's been really up and down for me, even though I totally appreciate the benefits. And then from there, I do have an office in Seattle. It's a workspace with a bunch of other creatives. It's kind of like a WeWork, but it's a one-off location called Tree Fort, super fun place with amazing people. And so a lot of the times when I'm, working behind the computer, I'm either off there or, off on appointments or calls or things of that sort.
I love that mixing in the kind of WeWork-ish space. We'll just call it a co-working space. So we don't want to give them free advertising. Tree Fort. So I love that for someone who's going to be working remotely soon. I feel this desire in my current life to, you know, be around people, even if I'm not actively talking to them all the time. It's just that little bit of connection where you feel like you're, you know, not so stir crazy that I think is really amazing. But going back to the travel piece that you said, it's so hard when you're in a good groove with a habit to then go travel and then come back and you're like, oh, but I'm tired. I want to catch up on X, Y, and Z. So I'm not going to get back into the habit that I was doing so well in before. I feel like that's such, that's such a challenge to do that. But speaking of travel, so you're obviously a photographer. You've been a photographer now for full-time for 4 years, you said. But before that, what was your life like? What was a typical day then?
Yeah, the chapter before photography is a period in my life when I can say that I had a typical day. So I was a practicing attorney, a commercial litigator to be specific, for 5 years, 3 years in Minnesota, and then when my wife and I moved to Seattle in 2013, I picked up practice again and practiced for another year and a half. So yeah, I was an attorney. That's my original career. From college, went right into law school in Minnesota, and then jumped right into commercial litigation at a pretty big national trial firm in Minneapolis. And so yeah, a typical day was, you know, heading into the office, you know, generally in a suit and tie, which, you know, couldn't be more different than, the attire of today, of what I do today. But, whether it was, behind the computer, emails, writing briefs, doing legal research, being an associate at a high powered, legal firm, was intense, challenging and rewarding at first. But eventually came to be, it eventually became clear that, I was drifting away from it from, an interest standpoint. And I knew it wasn't something I wanted to do 5-10 years down the road. And that kind of led into my transition and what I'm doing today.
So how long did you, you know, think that you wanted to be a lawyer? Like, you're pursuing this through school, you, in undergrad, you declare a major, you go for, like, you have all these years where you're prepping for, you're studying, you're, you know, interning, whatever, going down that path. Was there ever a question in your mind that, like, maybe this isn't the right thing? Or were you like, no, this is what I want to do, until you got there and then it was like not exactly what you expected and you felt yourself wanting something different?
Yeah. I got into the law primarily because I went to law school, and maybe taking two steps back, you know, I think in hindsight, it's kind of become clear to me that I was kind of floating in the wind a bit early on. You know, at college, I was actually a philosophy major, which, you know, is not the hugest, you know, is not the, you know, largest department. And, you can generally go two routes with a philosophy major. You can, you know, the only specialized route, I mean, to my understanding, is, you know, becoming like a philosophy, you know, professor or academic. Or you do something that just utilizes the skills that you develop as a philosophy major. And, I was at crossroads at that point in time in college, which way to go, because I very much loved philosophy and still do. But I decided to go, you know, maybe the more prudent route, the more established route, which is, you know, to go to law school, which isn't uncommon for philosophy majors, believe it or not. And so going into law school, I didn't know if I was going to be a practicing attorney or you use my legal, you know, education for some alternative legal career. But as law school does, it can, you know, guide people just in practice. And, after law school graduation, found myself at a big firm in Minneapolis. And I was super excited at that time, enthusiastic about it. I welcomed the challenge of the practice at that time, you know, huge cases and basically high stakes litigation. And I can say that it maybe took a few years for the interest to dwindle and for me to question whether that original career choice was for me. And sure enough, at that time, 2-3 years into practicing in Minneapolis is when my wife Jill and I got presented with the opportunity to move to Seattle as part of her taking a promotion with her employer at that time, and moving location. At that time, we always thought we could, we'd possibly make a move out of the Midwest. I didn't know where precisely we would go, but at that time it was Seattle that was the opportunity that was presented to us. And I thought this is a good opportunity to kind of have a refresh and start, retry law in another place, in another, legal community, perhaps a smaller setting. And that's exactly what we did when we moved out to Seattle. I found myself in a much smaller firm, much more casual, I should say, but still, a high quality firm. And it allowed me to basically sense whether it was the big firm environment that was maybe not fitting with my personality or just, my ambitions, or whether it was the law itself.
So from what I know about you and your recent work and just, looking through your photography, your portfolio, your projects, I mean, you are obviously a creative. I would classify you as a creative. You have a vision. You see composition. It's like, you create a story through an image and it's beautiful. And I wouldn't necessarily, maybe this is my own just kind of jaded perspective or experience, but like I went to business school. I feel like I'm a creative, but like I was a nearly straight A student except for business law. I think I got a D. And like I just couldn't in my mind marry the like legal concepts and like the real nitty gritty of like of all that, of the litigation. And it just didn't match up to what made sense for me. And I'm just curious your perspective on that as someone who is, has now done both.
Yeah, I can totally hear you that, given your interests early on, not being totally jazzed on business law. I'm not surprised by that, but yeah, it's been an interesting kind of dichotomy or just the relationship between, the right side, left side brain, being an attorney and even, you know, before that, being a philosophy major in college, you know, just, you know, developing the analytical muscle in your brain so much, you know, and I can't imagine it being, you know, more different than this creative muscle that I'm, you know, exercising from day to day as a photographer. And, you know, I've definitely had to shift and be a stronger, you know, have stronger creative capabilities. And that's, you know, that'll be an ongoing thing. I'm always trying to, ensure that my legal background and the analytical skills that I developed in that field don't kind of, you know, overpower my creativity. It's like kind of something I've worked on for years and will probably always work on. But, they, you know, even though they seem opposite, they sometimes complement each other. And then also in different aspects of my work, the analytical skills are incredibly helpful, believe it or not. And, you know, in a photography business role. So I have zero regrets, even though I did make what, you know, seemed like a 180 degree, you know, transition out of my original career, because I can glean tons of value from what I learned and, you know, the skill sets that I developed as an attorney. But that said, I'm so happy with what I'm doing right now. I couldn't be happier, and it's incredibly rewarding.
That's amazing. So, well, coming from Minnesota, so you're coming out to Seattle. Had you ever really been someone who is interested in big mountains or, you know, being outside as much as you are now? Or when did that kind of start to, when were you fostering that in your life?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and one that I've sorted through my head, you know, for a long time. I've often wondered why, when I moved to Seattle, the outdoor scene and specifically the Cascade Range basically like took over and basically started a transformation of what I do from day to day. And looking back, I think it's fair to say that I wasn't very outdoorsy. Although when I was a Minnesotan, I maybe would have said like, yeah, I'm outdoorsy. Like, yeah, of course. But no, in hindsight, it's pretty clear. Like, I maybe went on a few hikes a year. I never backpacked. One big regret I have is not going to northern Minnesota and experiencing the Boundary Waters, for example. I hope to be doing that soon. And, you know, that's just an example of how I wasn't taking advantage of the outdoor scene in the Midwest, which is a great one. And in terms of mountains specifically, I can say, although I hadn't had tons of experience with mountains, I did have some, you know, say hiking in California when my wife and I would visit some of her family that lives there, and, you know, in some travels abroad, Southeast Asia and elsewhere, little hints of experience in the mountains, but nothing compared to what I have today. Despite that, you know, dearth of experience in the mountains, I can say that I had this incredible intrigue. I recall being in Minnesota, and this was well before the idea of Seattle or let alone photography was ever in my head, being so intrigued by mountains. I remember watching documentaries on Everest and K2 and speed climbers in Yosemite and just being blown away. And so if I had to kind of pinpoint the origins of my interest in mountains, it was definitely in Minnesota, even if it wasn't, manifesting itself in a physical form, it was in my mind. And so I think it was kind of the foundation for where I took it when I moved to Seattle in 2013.
Well, that's a pretty good place to start to cut your teeth even more with the outdoors.
Absolutely.
So I know you mentioned photography obviously a couple times, and you are a photographer now, but when do you start picking up a camera and really starting to hone that craft?
Yeah, almost right away. Right after I moved to Seattle. Moved to Seattle in June 2013, and although at that time I had full intention of picking up the law again and restarting my legal practice there in Seattle, I basically just slowly started to experience the mountains and discover the Cascades for myself. At what was a single day hike into the Alpine Lakes wilderness, and you know, just east of Seattle, turned into a second hike and a third hike, and then several backpacking trips. And by the end of that first, season, late 2013, I started to get interested in mountaineering and discovered the North Cascades in Northern Washington, which totally captivated my imagination. And of course, by that time, the snow is starting to fall in the mountains. I, naively learned that I have no skill set, no experience to do anything in the mountains because I don't know navigation. I don't know anything to do with winter backcountry travel in the mountains. And it became clear by the end of that first, that first year, 2013, that I needed a different skill set, more experience to experience these mountains. So by the spring of 2014, I was lucky enough to land a spot in a alpine climbing course in Seattle with the Washington Alpine Club. It's a club similar to the Mountaineers, which either of you may have heard of. But as part of that course, basically learned the bread and butter of mountaineering and alpine climbing, whether that's glacier travel and use of an ice axe to ascend and descend and self-arrest, alpine rock and many other skills. And that was definitely a springboard that launched into launched me into the mountains further. So it was pretty fast transition from one single day hike in the Cascades, maybe a month after I moved to Seattle. Within a year, I'm wanting to do and I'm learning full on mountaineering. So it was a very exciting time for me.
Now, when you were heading out on those initial day hikes, you had just moved there, like, how did you go about finding a community of people, or did you have friends that you already knew that were kind of into this that you'd tag along, or what was the deal with like finding people to go on these hikes with you? And then did you take it further than they wanted to and then start to meet people through this course, or was their skill set ahead of yours? Just curious how you connected to this community after you moved.
Yeah, I, my very first hike, I have to thank, Jill's uncle who lives in the Seattle area. And he was the one that invited me to join him on that first hike, meaning my first hike in Cascades. And so I definitely have to attribute that first hike to him and his kind invitation. After that, him and I definitely did several other hikes. I, had the luxury of when we moved to Seattle, we did have these few pockets of friends that my wife Jill knew and that I quickly became friends with. And so I basically had a good foundation for several friends that were interested in the outdoors and that were basically on the same page as me, learning hiking and backpacking and light climbing. I also did things such as Meetup. You guys might be familiar with Meetup. So that was also a great way to basically learn other, or meet other people in the greater Seattle outdoor community and basically learn about other areas in the range. And so that's basically how I started, meeting people and getting outdoors in the that first year. But by the time I did that mountaineering course in spring 2014, that was, basically that was a huge source of connecting with people that are like-minded on a similar page in terms of learning how to climb in the mountains. And, that was a huge source of great friends that I can, I stay close with and get out in the mountains with often.
So now you're heading down this path of really developing your mountaineering skills. You're getting into the mountains more, you're doing bigger climbs, like you're shooting along the way. What was the kind of, where was the breaking point where you decided, I'm not going to practice law anymore. I want to go full on with this adventure outdoor photographer career.
Yeah, it was, the breaking point was around the turn of 2014 to 2015. And there's kind of two aspects to this story. One aspect I kind of already alluded to in that discovering the outdoor scene in Western Washington and getting out in the mountains. And also I failed to mention as my interest in the mountains grew, I was always there with camera, starting to take photos. And it started off with literally an iPhone and turned into a small point and shoot and then eventually a more serious camera. And so that, that interest in outdoor photography grew hand in hand with the outdoors right after that move to Seattle. So by the end of 2014, after having, you know, gotten more serious in, you know, learning mountaineering and alpine climbing and just traveling in the mountains, and also becoming way more serious in terms of outdoor photography, it became such a huge interest of mine. I again was confronted with this question of whether the law was for me. You know, when I was at the office in Seattle doing my job as a, you know, a legal associate and working on cases, whether it was a break or lunch or right after, my mind was in the mountains already. Like, that's where my mind went. And it became clear that I didn't want to be doing the law 5-10 years down the road. Now that's one aspect. It was just my personal interest and where I wanted to take my life. The other aspect that I mentioned, the second aspect, is a more personal one, relating to my family. And my father, who had been at that time about 10 years cancer-free, about 10 years prior, he did have a stint with throat cancer and got through it with radiation. Basically, by 2014, had a reoccurrence, you know, after 10 years being cancer-free. And it came on strong. And long story short, it became clear that Christmas of 2014 was going to be his last one. Again, this is at the exact same time that I'm trying to organize in my brain what I want to do with my life. But at the same time, a big part of me couldn't think about that, you know, in the last stage of my dad's life. And I basically, you know, every chance I had to be with him or speak with him, you know, despite my being in Seattle and Minnesota, I took many trips back to see him and to be with my family. And, you know, I did have, he knew of my struggles in my career and my wondering if I needed to do something different. And, you know, although he passed away in early 2015, before I made the jump from the law to photography, he did make clear that I should follow happiness and that I should do what I love. And, you know, it was clear that he was very proud of all that I did, but he was just so intrigued by my interest in the mountains. And he would say, just get out there and, you know, climb a mountain, you know, take a photograph, share what you've seen. And he literally said, like, I lived through that. And like that is, you know, I, you know, he meant the world to me, and he's with me every day, even though he passed in early 2015. And, after that, in the wake of his passing, a switch flipped, for me. And I tried to continue with the law, but it became clear that that wasn't what I wanted to do with my life. And once you have that conviction that you're saying, like, I'm on a path that I don't want to continue going on, it became clear to me that I needed to transition into doing what I loved, which was outdoor photography. although that transition was very unconventional and, you know, from an outsider's perspective was an 180 degree, you know, turn. So that's, you know, basically the story of the end of my legal career and how I jumped into the law, excuse me, how I jumped into photography. And I will say one other thing, you know, it's clear that it was just given my particular circumstances that I could make this jump. You know, my wife and I, you know, we're, you know, hardworking professionals and, you know, low or no debt. And, you know, we're very privileged. You know, I, you know, had the access to the outdoors. I was able to, you know, afford mountaineering gear and gear. And I kind of wanted to also note that I understand that not everyone can jump from, you know, maybe, you know, a particular career or path they're on that is unsatisfying, and they might not have that privilege to try something new. So I am aware that, you know, I was very fortunate to be able to make the transition and try it out, not knowing how long it would last, you know, whether it would be a year or a few months or longer. So, sorry, long-winded answer to that question, but, yeah, that's the story of how I jumped into photography.
Yeah, and I think that those types of moments are, and I mean, terrible, obviously, to lose someone that you love and that was so influential to your life, but can also just push you in the direction that you're supposed to be going in that maybe you couldn't have done yourself. So I think that that's a really beautiful thing that comes out of moments like that where, you know, you lose someone that you love so much. So I think that's a really beautiful part of that whole story.
Thank you.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it like you said, it's terrible, but it is interesting that, like, you know, for so many of us, whether it's that you had lost touch with, you know, certain family or friends until you're at a funeral, or you know, there are these moments that it's unfortunate that sometimes it takes death to inspire you to live and really wake up.
Yeah.
I think it's absolutely fascinating. I've read a lot about, you know, creativity, you know, having been an analytical mind in the law and philosophy, I've had to do my part to try to grow my creative muscle. And in books I've read, and also, others' stories, I've definitely seen this repeating thing of in the wake of trauma or tragedy, people do, kind of find the courage or just otherwise, you know, take action to basically re-divert their path in life and jump on a new course. And I think it's clear that was the case for me.
So that being the case, and in that moment, you know, noting that you were fortunate enough to be able to get the camera gear, get the mountaineering gear, give it a shot, and attempt this pursuit of real passion and happiness, how long did it take for things to start to click? Like, when did you really start to build a commercial portfolio or get the opportunity to shoot for big brands or commercial clients or start to grow a following? Like, what was the time frame like, and what were some of the things you were doing to make that happen?
Yeah, I would say the second year is kind of when I felt as if I was getting my feet underneath me, and kind of started at the, you know, it was by that time, that second year, that I, you know, felt as if what this business that I created was building momentum and was going in the right direction, and that had the potential to go many years down the road. That first year, man, I jumped, you know, it was like, you know, the whole, you know, the cliche jumping in and learning how to swim. That was totally me. I, you know, had never done, you know, never started my own business, had never really exercised that entrepreneurial muscle. And, you know, Jonathan, I know, you know, you're an entrepreneur in middle school, was it?
yeah, I grew up building a video production business with my brother when I was 11. He was 14, kind of early start to the freelance fire.
Okay, awesome. Well, so this is like second nature to you by now, right, I assume?
To an almost detrimental degree, yeah.
He's read a lot of books,
I have an obsessive compulsion about pursuing ideas that don't always work out. I kind of have that entrepreneurial ADD.
Hey, that sounds amazing to me. I wish I had been in your shoes early on and at least testing out entrepreneurial waters. But yeah, no, for me, it was... You know, it was only after, you know, once making that jump from the law to photography that I was forced to put on an entrepreneur's hat and give it my best shot, and learned a ton in the first year and in the second year. And, you know, even today, always learning, never do I have anything, you know, 100% set in stone, like, you know, I've made it or anything. No, it's always going to be a journey and just trying to grow in every way possible. But it was really the first year that invested a lot in photography gear and laid the foundation for some great client relationships and basically learning how to pitch a project, shoot an assignment, how to license imagery. I will say one thing, given my legal background, I'm a pro at licensing agreements, to the dismay of some brands. It was a big process, and learning how to not only start a business, but run a business that is basically set to succeed in the long term. You know, I'm going on over 4 years strong now, and I'm hoping I could do this as long as I'm able to, and because I find it so rewarding.
That's an interesting point you brought up about the licensing agreements. Like, I want to dig into this a little bit, because it's, you know, in like today's social media landscape, it's so easy for brands to come across crowdsourced content and for people to be so stoked to like, yeah, take my image, just repost it and tag me, right? Yeah. And like, when you're trying to build a real career in photography, like that's a kind of a detriment to you, because brands come, you know, expecting a lot cheaper or free or, you know, whatever that reciprocity is. And one of the guys, a friend of mine, Tim Burke, who we've had on the show in the past, he had, you know, talked about having taken shots of his bike. He was on, you know, riding his motorcycle around the world and took these incredible photos. And the maker of that bike had like grabbed a shot without asking him. And like he saw it as an ad on social one day and was like, what is this? So like, how do you navigate that environment?
Yeah, it's definitely a reality of the current industry. You know, more than ever, there are more photographers than ever, you know, especially since we all have, you know, these cameras on our iPhones and smartphones. There definitely is a place for user generated content, I believe. And I think there is even a place for, say, a budding photographer to tackle a project either for free or on a speculative basis, you know, on spec, right off the bat, maybe as an isolated instance, just to get their foot in the door. Like, I have to recognize when, you know, if another photographer is willing to, you know, give, you know, imagery away or shoot an assignment for free, it could be that they're just trying to, you know, they're at the very beginning of their career that they're trying to build. And they want to get their foot in the door, and they want to have one, you know, say one project to point to when they pitch that second project. So although it definitely has an impact on the industry as a whole and how brands say pick up, you know, imagery and content, I am, you know, cognizant of there's a time and place for those things. You know, in terms of what I do and how I, you know, basically, you know, run my business in light of that reality, I just ensure that I do everything from start to finish, you know, whether it's from the initial contact or, you know, negotiation or project pitch all the way to image delivery, you know, literally delivering the end files, that everything's done at a professional level and that I'm, you know, delivering something of value that they wouldn't get from, say, a hobbyist or wouldn't get from user generated content. And so far, taking that approach and always refining it and always improving upon it has been successful for me. And also just being smart about, you know, the use of my images when, you know, you mentioned wanting to revisit licensing. You know, whenever I deliver an image, I'm always wanting to be on the same page with the client about where and for how long the images will be used. And you know, before somebody jumps into photography, licensing kind of is this foreign thing. Sometimes, you know, early on, you know, for a photographer that hasn't become familiar with licensing or professional photography, and they get reached out, you know, a brand reaches out and says, "Hey, we'd love to use this image." And that's not really, in my mind, a yes or no question. It's always, how are you going to use it and for how long? It's like you went to the grocery store and you're like, "I'd like to purchase a bag of groceries." And they say, "That would be, you know, X amount of dollars." No, that begs the question of what's going to go into that bag of groceries. So if you want to use this image, what's going to go into that use of the image? Is it going to be on your website? Is it going to be on your social media? Is it going to be in a print magazine? If any of those, for how long, things of that sort. So yeah, learning basically just the lay of the land in terms of licensing and how to protect copyright in your image has been a useful kind of, you know, just building block in my business. And it's definitely ensured that my images are used by the client and are of value to them, and also protects my just ownership and copyright in the image.
Yeah, that's a good thing to note. Like, that's not something that I necessarily would know as someone who is not in the industry, right? Or I would be just stoked, like Jonathan said, to like, oh, the brands want to use my image. That's cool. But that can deteriorate the brand perception of you, I guess, in your photography work. So that's good to note. I was thinking about the transition from being a lawyer or an attorney to being a photographer and having to create pitch decks and go to brands or go to projects, and basically like selling yourself and your work, and the transition between, like, of course, in a job setting, you have to, you know, work hard, but generally after your interview and after you have the job, you don't have to continue to sell yourself all the time. And so I wondered what that transition is like from going to having sort of a, you know, very clear expertise in the area. That's why you have this job. You don't have to continuously talk about why you should be hired or why you should be working with this person, et cetera. So can you talk a little bit about that transition?
Yeah, if I understand the question, it was a huge transition that I had to make in my mind, you know, as a, as an attorney at a firm. You know, I had, you know, a set salary, and I knew when I needed to be at work and when I needed to leave. And, I didn't really have any sort of entrepreneurial, you know, roles. Right. As a junior or mid-level associate. So it definitely took, you know, basically me to shift my mind and say, you know, once I get one project, I need to follow up with the client and ensure that, you know, what they received is a value, and basically nurture the relationships as they go. And, you know, so it's kind of like planting seeds. You know, if, you know, I'm wanting to work with one brand down the road, it could be maybe even 6 months before I even have a clear opportunity to work with them. I just reach out and introduce myself, or say at a networking event, I make sure to connect with a representative. And it's just a completely different frame of mind from where I was in the law to what I'm having to do now. But I think it's exciting, especially because just the subject matter. You know, me shooting outdoor photography, you know, often mount related. I'm super excited to talk about it and enthusiastic to talk about it. So any networking or any nurturing of, you know, client relationships to ensure that they lead to, you know, a second or third or a project or even a long-term, you know, retainer-based partnership or things like that it comes more naturally now that the subject matter that I'm working with is something that I'm just so interested in.
Now, how does somebody who's just starting out really start to assign value to themselves and figure out what they are worth or what their time's worth or what their images are worth? I know that that's like often one of the hardest things for people who are new in the industry, and they're, you know, they don't have a baseline to frame anything against. They don't know what they should charge.
Yeah, that's one of the most difficult things. And I, in addition to doing, you know, assignments and you know, licensing and campaigns and things of that sort, I also do photo education, not only on the technical side of, you know, how to use your camera and how to, you know, compose, but also do workshops on the business of photography. And that's the one thing I communicate all the time. It's pricing, you know, your work, whether it's image licensing assignments, is at least in the area that I work, which is, you know, outdoor commercial related photography, is never easy. There are so many factors, you know, the size of the client, the level of production that the project is requiring, the quantity of image, the scope of licensing, and so on and so on. There's so many variables. So it's an incredibly difficult thing. And even to date, it will be, is always a bit of a task to kind of find that number for pricing a gig. But taking a step back and just talking about value more generally, I always just encourage if a budding photographer or hobbyist comes to me and says, hey, how do I get into photography? I always say, just first and foremost, you know, putting aside licensing, you know, in particular, pricing, just value your work. And I think that's one thing that kind of undercuts a lot of, you know, budding photographers, is they fail to do that. And, you know, if you don't value your work, how can you expect anyone else, whether it's a brand or company or other individual, to do so? So I think at first it's basically ensuring that your mind is looking at your work and seeing the value before anything else. Beyond that, when you're talking about day rates and things like that, I always recommend, you know, calculating, say, your costs of doing business, reaching out to other established photographers and just understanding like the lay of the land. And that's exactly what I did before I jumped from before that day when I was 100% attorney. And then the next day I was 100% photographer. I chatted with as many established photographers as I could in the Northwest and elsewhere, and basically just understood, like, tried to get a sense of the lay of the land, you know, how, you know, what the market was like. And that definitely helped. And I would encourage anyone, you know, any photographer who's interested in doing full-time photography to chat with established photographers or others in the industry. And you'll sure enough, you know, learn more and more and more and be much more confident when you settle on your day rate or a price for a particular image licensing.
Yeah. Well, it's great that you do like the business side of photography workshops. I don't think that we've really necessarily heard of that before. At least I haven't, which I think is really helpful, because it's like I feel like some of the creative stuff, like, yeah, you can kind of play around with that a little bit more, but those business questions are like hard and fast and something that you can't necessarily know the answer to or the outline for very well. But so I think that's amazing. So many people I assume those are very popular because there's so many people out there trying to be, especially outdoor photographers.
Yes.
You're like, maybe too many. No. but I wanted to dive into this 50 Peaks project that we chatted a little bit about before we started recording, but do you want to kind of lay that out and what it entails and maybe why you wanted to go after that goal in 2018?
Yeah. So in a nutshell, the project involved me climbing 50 peaks inside North Cascades National Park during the climbing season last year, 2018. So yeah, North Cascades National Park is one of the three national parks in Washington State, the other two being Rainier and Olympic. And it's safe to say that North Cascades is not just lesser known within Washington State, but just one of the least known parks, you know, throughout the national park system. It's consistently one of the lesser visited parks, and despite that, it's largely where I came to discover the mountains for myself. Like I said, you know, when I got to Seattle, I slowly started to hike and backpack and eventually got into climbing in the Cascade Range. And it was always the North Cascades, which I've always described as the peaks north of Glacier Peak in, you know, central northern Washington, that are the most rugged, the most remote, and just the peaks that, you know, are in my daydreams when I'm dreaming about the mountains. So without exaggeration, this range, the North Cascades Range, and this national park were a big driver in me jumping from the law to photography. And so leading up to 2018, I learned that this park was turning 50 years old in 2018. It was established in 1968. And I knew right away I wanted to celebrate this national park in some unique way. And it didn't take long, but I almost immediately had the idea of what if I climbed 50 peaks inside the park boundary to celebrate the anniversary and to also just shine a light on this public land and this kind of local landscape that changed my life. And the idea turned into me asking, you know, my close mountaineering and climbing friends, hey, do you think this is even possible, you know, within a climbing season? And, you know, which, you know, in the Cascades, you know, in an area known for unpredictable weather and pretty devastating conditions most of the year, the climbing season, I would say, is generally about 5 months. So it's not, even though it was kind of a year-long project, I was really talking about a 5-month window. And making, you know, making do with any weather windows within that 5-month period. But by spring of 2018, almost 1 year ago, I committed to the project and said, heck, let's do this. And I'm going to give this a shot. And along the way, in addition to just, climbing and sharing the experiences that I have in climbing those 50 peaks, I'm also going to fundraise on behalf of the park and just, shine a light on the park and its, solid administration, as well as the an organization called Washington's National Park Fund, which is kind of the exclusive charitable partner for the parks. Basically, it's the organization that would receive any donations that would go directly to those Washington national parks, including North Cascades National Park. So I wanted to ensure that the project had a good give back component in addition to just me carrying out this physical feat of climbing 50 peaks. So by mid-May, I basically actually started and set foot on the trail and started with peak number one. And almost or exactly 5 months later in October, mid-October 2018, last year, I stepped on peak 50. And I can't tell you how grateful I am to have decided to do that project for a park and mountain range that I thought I knew well. It was clear I had just been scratching the surface. And the project took me to some of the most remote corners in the park and to some peaks that, as a Minnesotan had certainly never heard of. I mean, and for that matter, I'd never even heard of North Cascades National Park when I was a Minnesotan. And so to explore the park to the extent I did was something that will stay with me for the rest of my life.
Now, 50 peaks within like a park boundary is no small number, and there likely may be many more there, but I'd imagine some of these are, walk-ups to the top, like pretty easy hikes, and some are like real technical climbing. What was the scope of that? How easy or hard was the majority of this?
So I knew right away I wasn't going to be doing the 50 highest peaks. I knew right away I wasn't going to be doing the 50 highest peaks. I knew that was going to be too big of a bite to chew in a single season. And by not choosing the 50 highest, I was also ensuring that I would be kind of canvassing the entire park. Other areas or regions that maybe wouldn't be represented if I did the highest 50. But of the 50 that I climbed, is a pretty big range of technical ability. I can say that the bulk of the 50 that I climbed were class 3 or class 4 climbs, scrambles, either not involving a rope or involving some light rope work, glacier travel, things of that sort. There were a small handful that I would definitely consider, more strenuous walk-ups, not quite class 3 even. And then there were quite a few also that were, say, class 5 rock climbs. So whether it was one or multi-pitch rock climbing on sometimes a magnificent rock, quality rock, and sometimes the most horrible choss you can ever encounter in the mountains. So, huge range of in terms of, technical climbs, and that was fun, in that after getting done with a class 3 climb, I knew right off the bat I was going to be, tackling this, the class, 5-4 West Ridge of Forbidden Peak in the North Cascades or some other glacier climb that involving glacier travel. So it kind of kept me guessing and made it really exciting. I never really knew what I was going to be getting into, from climb to climb.
So now beyond it being just a seriously impressive notch in your climbing belt to do that many in a season and explore the park in the way that you did, and then, of course, the impact with the Washington National Park Fund, what is coming of this project publicly?
Yeah, what's coming would largely be a book that I'm preparing at the moment, and it's largely a recap of the climbing itself, as well as just my own personal story of how I came to discover the range for myself. I always have to take a step back and And I'm just amazed at how this place that I was unfamiliar with, I had never heard of North Cascades National Park, became this something that is so big in my mind and something that changed my life. And so the book definitely covers the personal story of me discovering the range and the park and what that meant for, you know, what I do from day to day. But the bulk of the book will be covering the 50 climbs themselves, and it'll be heavily supported by photos as well as a fair bit of writing, and that should be coming out later this spring. Super excited to get that out. It's taken a bit more time than I had originally planned, but you know, I guess that's probably a common deal for anybody writing a book, even one that's, you know, heavily supported by photos. But wanted to make sure that I would do it right, get a solid book out there that I can, you know, share with friends and family and offer to others for sale. And just to have a final product that I could be proud of. It's also important to me that the majority of the proceeds will be going back to the park in the same way that I was fundraising for the park when I was doing the actual project. And that's important to me, in that I just always want to ensure that this isn't about me, and it's not about, you know, the physical feat of 50 climbs, which, you know, like, as I mentioned, weren't terribly technical. And a lot of these are very, you know, accessible or doable for, you know, the average outdoorist, I'd say, but it's about the park. It's about public lands. It's about how we connect with public lands. And I wanted to ensure that there was a give back component as part of the book. So
I love that. So is the book going to be called 50 Peaks Project?
It is. How did you know? That was a heck of a guess.
Just a shot in the dark. Amazing. Well, we'll be sure to link that up, you know, when it's available on the exact date, so people can get it for their own coffee table. I imagine it's going to be a nice big book like that coffee table style.
Yeah, yes, absolutely. And thank you in advance for doing that.
Of course. So what's next for you, man? I know you've got, like, you mentioned that you do these photo workshops and photo business workshops, and I know you will be rolling out some in 2019. What else is on the agenda?
Yeah, so after Arizona here, I'm off to California for a project with Eddie Bauer, and then immediately heading to Utah. My beautiful wife is running her first 100K. She's an ultra marathon runner. And I took the task of being her, not only her crew, but also her pacer. So we'll be running in Zion, just outside Zion National Park, a big trail race next week. And then after that, I'm fortunate enough to head down to Patagonia for 3 weeks, which will be based at El Chalten, and it'll be part personal travel, but part work as well. Always shooting wherever I am in the world. And then after that, largely back in the Pacific Northwest, and we'll be, yeah, kind of sticking around the big backyard and doing more and more projects and more assignments in Washington and in the surrounding states.
Now, of the 100K that you're pacing, how much will you run?
I think it'll be, I have to double check, but I think it's about 13 miles. Which, yeah, I should say, so she's definitely rubbed off on me in that she's had me sign up for my first 50 miler next month, which we're actually going to be running together in full in Bryce. So although I'm running 13 miles as her pacer next week, it's just part of the training for my own race next month. So
nice.
Damn, man. Well, good luck with that. That's quite the
thank
you. Chunk.
I definitely need the good luck. Although I did two marathons back when I was a Minnesotan, that was many, you know, several years ago. So I'm going to need all the luck I can get. So, and Emily, are you, did I read your marathon runner as well?
Yeah, well, I've run one road, one trail, and I have a 50K on my docket for August right now, but I don't have any other races yet, but I am moving to Colorado, so I think that I will start to add more to my roster. So aspirationally, your wife seems to be doing it right, so I think think she could be a role model
maybe,
for me.
Maybe you should run to Colorado. Just ship your stuff and just run there.
No, that's a great idea. Yep.
Sounds like she's sold.
Yeah, I am excited.
That's the voice of someone who's not skeptical.
I'm trying to get into it, and I loved our marathon, and Jonathan and I ran together trail marathon that we ran late last year, and that was like just kind of fueled a little bit of the fire within me. So I'm excited to start making that more of a priority.
And I've forgotten how much it hurt to even think about signing up for one again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's
brings
hard.
Brings back some memories. Yeah.
So Scott, we are kind of at the end, and the last question that we ask all of our guests is, what does Stoke mean to you?
Although I knew that you guys would be asking that question, I honestly have not settled on a solid answer. So I'm sure that some people have, that, you know, they've thought thoroughly about it and know exactly what they're going to say, but that's not me today. So But what I will say, and I hope this makes some sense, I think there's two different aspects. One is kind of this kind of a feeling in preparation or leading up to an actual experience. And for me, you know, as I mentioned, when I was an attorney, you know, before I jumped into outdoor photography and made, you know, the mountains what I do from day to day, when I was on, you know, taking a break, you know, from the legal practice or at lunch, or, you know, when I was done for the day and catching the bus back to my home in Seattle, you know, where my mind went was the mountains. And I think it has to do with like where your mind goes when you're like daydreaming, and what, you know, when you need not think about, say, a task or a chore or work, it's where your mind goes. And for me, yeah, the Stoke, you know, I was stoked on the mountains, and it was only a matter of time when I had to make the mountains what I do, you know, from day to day. And so I think there's that aspect. You're kind of like, you know, leading up to an experience. And then I think there's Stoke that is part of an experience too. For me, it's, you know, after miles of trail or bushwhacking and getting to the top of a peak, that feeling, when you reach the top and all the, you know, the misery that I've endured, you know, culminates to this, you know, unexpected view on the top of a peak, and I'm looking out across a landscape that just blows me away. Like that is also Stoke. And for others, it could be, you know, finishing, a marathon or a trail race. It could be, you know, getting barreled while surfing, which is something I've never done. So hopefully I described that correctly. And, you know, or any other activity, you know, where it's just, you know, the height of your emotion, and it kind of is a representative moment of why you do what you do. So
that's good. I mean, for not knowing what you were going to answer there, that was a great answer. I love it.
No, that was great.
Yeah.
Why you do what you do. It's beautiful.
That's what Stoke means. It's awesome. Well, thanks so much, Scott. So if people want to follow along and hear about any updates in your life, is Instagram the best place to find and chat with you?
Yeah, I'd say my website or Instagram. My website is my name with a hyphen. Yeah, scott-crans.com. It's a different story why I can't get that unhyphenated version. I won't bore you with that. And on Instagram is my name as well, Scott_Crans. So really just grateful you guys had me on. It was awesome to chat with you. And just excited to keep listening to the Stokecast after this one. And appreciate you guys' time.
We appreciate you, Scott. Thank you.
Emily, what a good episode. What a good chat with Scott, huh?
I know. It really was wonderful. I really, really liked him and his story, and he was so wonderful. Wonderful is the word.
Wonderful is the word. He's just a really genuine guy. You can just tell with like the natural candor of the conversation, and just he's got a kind spirit, I would say. One thing, thinking back on the conversation, that really I think resonated with me, as well as I would imagine anybody listening, is when we started asking him about, like, does he have any kind of morning routine or like daily habits that contribute to fueling I don't know, his drive or his efficiency or whatever, you know, the different parts of your life. And he was just kind of saying how, like, no, he has had a lot of difficulty in developing those habits. And, like, there are certain things that he does depending on where he's at, if he's, like, at the shop or in the field or with the family or whatever, and how it's just, you know, subject to the environment and the context of what's going on. But just that fact of, like, difficulty in developing habits is universally understood, I think. We all try to do more and get more habitual about certain things that we know are going to be good for our lives, whether it's less of something or more of something. We're all trying, I think, very often, very frequently to create or break habits, and it's just a hard thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I find it really funny. I mean, we ask these people, these really successful people, like, their morning routines. And while I do think there are some, like, really good answers to that question, I also think it's, like, funny the amount of people who are just like, I have no idea. Like, I just get up and I drink coffee and then I leave and I don't go do my thing. Or I, like, you know, it doesn't, like, every single day is different. Or whatever. And I'm just like, oh, so there really is no, like, concrete way. And you just have to figure out what works for you. And even sometimes then you have to, like, continuously tweak it all the time, depending on, you know, like, what motivates you and, like, your schedule. And just, I think it's kind of funny because, you know, it's just kind of like we expect, like, okay, well, if you can have a good morning routine, then you will be a success. And I think there is a lot to be said for the morning routine, whatever that ends up being for each person. And, like, to have a routine is really helpful. But I just think it's funny the amount of varied answers people give who are, you know, also successful.
I agree. But that actually made me think of something. So my brother Chris has a column on Inc. magazine, inc.com. And where he writes, you know, a few posts a month and just about business and process efficiency. And when I was, like, helping him brainstorm some different topics that he could write about, like, we were kind of throwing ideas at the wall for what he might do some posts around. And if you look at Inc., if you see anything from Inc. that's shared, or if you ever go to the website, it's, you know, it's just like Fast Company or all these different business publications, Entrepreneur, Forbes, Founder. They all have those kind of clickbait articles, which are like the five things that Jeff Bezos does before 6 a.m. or, like, the, you know, Elon Musk's morning habits and like, you know, Richard Branson's secret morning habits to becoming a billionaire. And we were joking about him writing something like, why I don't care about Elon Musk's morning routine and you shouldn't either. Because, like, his routine should not be yours because you are not him. Your routine is going to be different than a multi-billionaire. There's just no ifs, ands, and buts about that. Like, right. Your morning is going to look different than Elon's. And while we're just so drawn to, like, wanting to grasp on to, like, what do the most successful people do that I can replicate? But when it really comes down to it, yeah, you can pick up some insights and tips and stuff like that, but it is entirely individual, and those kind of, like, clickbait posts are just a little bit BS.
Yeah, so shout out to Brendan Lehner, one of our past guests. He had a great, really satirical essay about morning routines that I think I posted on my Instagram, but maybe we could add it to the show notes too. It's like, basically you just have a cup of coffee and then you have another cup of coffee and then eventually you've drank the whole pot and that's just your morning and you don't really understand what happens to you. But no, it was really funny. So I read that and I was like, this is what I actually, you know, think it is. Oh, everyone's just like, BS. Yeah.
It was so funny. I know the post you're talking about. It was just a few weeks ago. I got the, you know, in semi-rad in my inbox and I was dying laughing. It was like, just so, I mean, that's just his shtick though. It's like, it's the reason stand-up works, the reason his content works is because it's just observation that is true, because it's like, you know, it's absurd because it is true.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. So definitely check that out too. But one of the other things I think we've talked about a couple times, maybe on the podcast, but I don't know if it's been belabored too much, but I think that Scott obviously had a death and a very close death to him, and that kind of sparked his thought about, you know, maybe I should pursue this full time, and I should go for it and just, you know, live the life I actually want to live. And I thought that that was really also vulnerable of him to share, and lovely that he felt comfortable doing that, but also just, you know, a good reminder back to times in all of our lives where something like that has happened. We've lost someone, and it's kind of snapped us into having this like crazy amount of perspective about life. I had a death last year that kind of made me wobble a lot and think about, okay, well, what is the point of X, Y, and Z, and what do I actually want to do here in this time that I have? So I think that was, you know, another good point of conversation with him is just thinking about that. And you know, unfortunately, death definitely teaches us that, but maybe trying to put the line of thinking into your more, you know, weekly or monthly thought process about what you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, it is unfortunate that, you know, there's like a silver lining in it that is hard to admit because you don't want to admit that there's anything good about that. But of course, you know, when you can find good in the bad, it is a good trait. And unfortunately, it does sometimes take those dramatic life moments, those losses, to catalyze you, to wake you up, to follow your big dream, to, you know, do what you want to do, to really like seize it and live life like you should, right? And I mean, for me, I can think back to 2012, living in Aspen, and one of my best friends died on Aspen Highlands snowboarding on a powder day. His board went, like, you know, they were back in the glades, and his board went underneath a log that was hidden under the snow, and it sent him flipping forward and into another, like, you know, branch, and it was a horrible accident, and lost a great friend. And it was really, really tough at the time. But, you know, looking back, that wake-up call and that trauma with our friend group was a big reason why Ethan, Ryan, and I didn't let go of Between the Peaks when, you know, all the obstacles were there, the finances, the lack of X, Y, and Z, of press or funding or you know, uncertain logistics or whatever. Like, we pursued it because, you know, in a big way, because of that.
Yeah. And I'm sure that also for you and for Scott, too, you get closer to those people around you who are going through a similar trauma, and you have this kind of, again, it's like the unfortunate, but there is a silver lining to it, that you feel closer to those people because they all know what it was like, exactly what you went through, and you know what it's like for them. And it's just kind of this beautiful human moment that happens in those terrible human moments.
Totally. Yeah. And so, I mean, for me, obviously, like, the trajectory of my life changed when I pursued Between the Peaks because of those moments. And for Scott, like, the trajectory of his life changed when he pursued this career as an adventure outdoor photographer, storyteller, really leaned into that after his dad kind of gave him, you know, that permission to do it and to live his most passionate life. And the big project that came out of that was his 50 Peaks project. And, you know, that's such an incredible thing, like, really just exploring every nook and cranny of the North Cascades. And I for one, can't wait to check out his coffee table book. And I know that there's not necessarily a date on when it's dropping yet, but as soon as we have it, we're going to put that in the show notes. So anybody listening to this, you know, in future episodes, if it's not out yet, you'll be able to still find it on exploreinspired.com/Scott Kranz. You'll be able to check out the book, and also the book, proceeds from the book go to support the North Cascades National Park. Really, I admire, you know, Scott's work and this project that he, like, that takes some serious dedication. That's not just like going out for a big trek in a national park and then like putting out a photo series or writing a post, right? Like, he dedicated a year to just the North Cascades, to 50 Peaks for its 50th anniversary, got all these stories, all these photos. Like, that's a cool project. I so admire people that go after like these just large kind of expeditionary pursuits, right? Whether it's adventure or business, like just going all in on this one thing that you name it. There's an start and an end, and there's parameters around what's it going to be to accomplish it, and you create a lot. You know, there's different legs to it, and I love that. It's like turning adventure into a business, and that is appealing to me.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, I'm really excited to see the book. And honestly, it's motivated me. I mean, I have not been to the North Cascades. I don't know if you have, but he's right, right? I mean, there's great national parks in Washington, and that is not one that comes to mind immediately, right? You think of Mount Rainier, you think of Olympic, you know, you don't think of North Cascades as much. And it looks so, so beautiful. So I'm excited. And we all, me and Jonathan, just the two of us. Hope you enjoyed our conversation with Scott. And as always, thank you so much for listening. And if you are liking what you're hearing and you haven't already left a review, please do so. It really is helpful. And we know a lot of you have left some recently, and we really, really appreciate that. And we love them. We love reading them, and they're just super helpful for growing the show.
Also, to like this conversation that we've just been having, if you have, like, you know, just like for me, it was Between the Peaks, and for Scott, it was this 50 Peaks project. If you have like some big grand like adventure project, business idea or whatever that like you maybe have just started working towards, or you're in the middle of, or you know, it's in your mind, but you've been afraid to like say it or put it out there, like, please let us know. We want to have that conversation with you. Tag us in a story, hit us in the DM. We want to know what big project, big pursuit, big expedition, big business, whatever is going to, you know, shift your life and send you down a new trajectory in a really cool, meaningful way. Because I know you're probably thinking of something. It's probably right there in the back of your mind. Maybe you've been listening to a few Stokecast episodes and feeling inspired by different guests and trying to put together your own idea, your own path, whatever. And if you have it, let us know. Because anything we can do to help, we of course want to.
Absolutely. So thanks so much, guys. And we will catch you next week.
Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Emily Holland.
And I'm Jonathan Ronzio. We'll catch you next week with another episode of the Stokecast.